KQED.
Support for the California Report comes from the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children and youth at risk. The California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected, on the web at theschmidt.org.
On today's California Report magazine, we meet a homeless woman who survived after someone set fire to the tent next to hers. She lost her dogs and her voice. But in the Oakland encampment where she lives, people look out for each other.
I still stuck by her side because, I was like the only friend. Basically, friend or family member she got, so.
And we'll visit another tight-knit community, a Silicon Valley restaurant that served up the same blueberry coffee cake for 40 years. It's a place where everybody knows your name.
Kind of like the old Cheers thing. They want to be recognized. They want to know the employees. People come in here and they hug employees.
Plus, why California kids, including mine, won't be drinking a cancer-causing chemical in their tap water anymore. I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. Your state, your stories. Lately, we've been hearing a lot from our listeners when we air profiles of homeless people in California. A couple weeks ago, many of you responded with offers of help after hearing our special Homeless You, checking back in on the homeless college students we've been following. Now we're going to turn to a story about a group most people think of when they think about homelessness, people who live in tent cities. More of these encampments have been sprouting up in many of California's largest cities, lining streets and freeway underpasses. You see that a lot in Oakland, a place that prides itself on tackling social issues. But the city struggled to help homeless encampments while also trying to welcome new development. KQED's Devin Katayama spent time with some residents in one of those encampments and tells us about what makes these homeless communities vulnerable and also strong.
Do you remember when you realized you could tell time by the BART train?
It's just something, you know, when you just have time to yourself and some people read a book, you just sit around and listen. It's very, listen to the train. Instead of water, I got traffic.
Instead of water, you have traffic. Instead of a clock, you have BART.
Yeah.
Tootsie Tages is having a hard time talking. She lives in one of the larger tent encampments in Oakland. It's underneath the West Oakland BART tracks. On an early morning in May, before the sun was up, someone set fire to the tent next to hers. Three tents were destroyed. She got out in time, but her voice is damaged, and she's shaken up.
They let it burn. And I was yelling. My puppies were in there. It was just a whole lot. Like, I just stopped crying. And that was hours ago. Like, I went from all that to just this.
And what is this for people who can't see it?
It was nothing.
She's got a small basket of stuff, but the rest is burned. She even lost her dogs. Have you already gone through the fire and the debris?
I had to get my puppies.
The Oakland Fire Department has flagged almost three dozen incidents at encampments as possible arson since January 2016. The department has seen so many of these that they've created a new dispatch code to track the data. The Red Cross is even piloting an emergency response to some of Oakland's encampment fires like this one. The encampments in some places are becoming so large they're blocking sidewalks and spilling into the streets in some areas. People are creating homes with what they've got, which makes them vulnerable to fires like this one.
I was spoiled out here. I was spoiled. I had the biggest tent. I had TVs, electricity, all the refrigerator. It was just like an apartment.
How'd you have electricity?
Through fuses and generators. You know, it's all. It doesn't matter where you live, is how you live. You know. Oh, I had everything. I was finally content.
What are you going to do tonight?
I don't even know.
The number of people living outside in Oakland grew by more than a third to almost 2,000 in the last 2 years. The nonprofit that provides homeless outreach for the city estimates there are as many as 200 homeless encampments in Oakland. Some suspect that as the city gentrifies, the development is pushing people from once unused and invisible spaces out into the open. These encampments are often referred to as families by the people who live in them. People are often looking out for each other here. But holding these families together is this need to survive. When desperation for survival increases, so does the pressure on the family. Tootsie's phone was burned in the fire, but she gave me a number where she could be reached. When I called it a couple of weeks later, I get Sylvester Abraham. After the fire, Tootsie lived with Sylvester in a tent a few spots down in the same encampment. When I asked for Tootsie, Sylvester tells me she's in the hospital.
A friend of mine told me Tootsie got hit by a car. So I'm like, okay, I'm like, wow, for real? And he's like, yeah, come on. And then he walked me, he showed me where it was at.
There aren't many details about the accident, but Sylvester says Tootsie broke a few ribs and had to have surgery. Sylvester says he's about to head to the hospital to see her.
But I'm finna go up there today to go bring her some change of clothes and all that.
Tootsie's had a hard year. Her mom passed in February. Her tent burned in May, and now the accident. When I last spoke with her before the accident, she was hungry. Someone came by and donated some bagels and water. Sylvester says churches often come by to help out. But for the most part, people in encampments like this one are relying on who they know.
So I still stuck by her side because, I was like the only friend. Basically, friend or family member she got. So, I had to be a good friend to her because that's sad, though. Yeah.
Having friends and a social network is important at encampments like this one. And there's this one word that keeps coming up that I've heard at other encampments, which seems to help determine who your friends and family are. Why someone would visit you in the hospital and bring you clothes, or why someone would try to burn your tent in the first place. That word is respect, and it's something Jeffrey Hill talks a lot about. Jeffrey says his tent was the target of the fire. What does respect look like in an encampment like this?
Well, right now it's quite hard because there's too many people. When it was less people, I mean, respect is respect.
Jeffrey's been living at this encampment for a number of years. He watched it grow from just a few tents to dozens. He says this growth makes it harder to keep order. Jeffrey says even though this encampment is like a family, people still steal from each other. He says sometimes it's petty and someone can be forgiven. Other times it can lead to rifts or fights.
There's a lot of people that's new to the way we run things, and it is difficult for them. They stumble, they trip, and they fall. But if they're good people, if they're worthy enough, we try to save them. If not, we kick them to the curb.
Jeffrey says there are hierarchies in some encampments. I've heard of presidents, mayors, or kings. Jeffrey says that he's pretty high up, but he doesn't give a title. You can tell he knows a lot of people at this encampment, though. Some come over to talk to him while I'm there. But having status doesn't make you free from having to watch your back.
So when you go to sleep, do you feel safe?
I don't sleep sound. Never have. So it's always I feel on guard.
Jeffrey also feels on guard because he's been incarcerated most of his life, since he was about 12 years old, he says. Out here, even though he calls it a family, he still says it's like prison rules.
You just got to go by the rules. You just got to know right and wrong, where to be and where not to be.
And when you say kind of prison rules, what does that mean?
Basically, just watch out for your own ass. Have each other's back.
At least out here, Jeffrey says he feels free. He's already set up a new tent about a block away from where the fire was. He says he can pack up all the stuff he owns in about half an hour if he needs to. He says he's not trying to get off the streets. This right here is pretty much home. For the California Report, I'm Devin Katayama in Oakland.
Head to Silicon Valley, a place that's all about fast-paced change. The Valley's startup and cash-out culture means companies frequently change owners, get new bosses, take on new identities. But there are exceptions. As part of a new series we're calling Family Biz, the California Report's Ryan Levy tells us about one Silicon Valley restaurant that's working to keep things the way they've been.
Hobie's Restaurant has sat on this main drag in Palo Alto for almost 40 years. So when a huge yellow sign appeared in the window earlier this summer announcing a change in ownership, it was a big deal.
When I saw the transfer sign, I was concerned.
Tim Diebert has been a Hobie's regular for 30 years, ordering his favorite chorizo scramble with runny eggs almost every day since he retired 2 years ago.
And then I learned that it was Danny and Camille, and when I learned that they were going to acquire the place, I knew things weren't going to change.
Diebert was confident things weren't going to change because Danny and Camille Chihate, they've been working at Hobie's for almost 30 years. Danny in the kitchen, and Camille as a waitress and manager.
So this opportunity was like amazing for us because it was sort of like our lifelong dream to be able to do this.
Hobie's doesn't look like other Silicon Valley restaurants. There's an old-fashioned salad bar, lots of space between tables, and the servers sometimes wear bright Hawaiian shirts.
We've never wanted to be slick.
Ted Fike is the outgoing owner of Hobie's.
It's just not a slick presentation. It's very homespun.
After managing the business for years, Fike and his husband Peter were ready for a change. Hobie's was founded by Peter's father, a Hawaii transplant named Paul Tabor, in 1974. What started as a single hamburger shop in Mountain View morphed and grew into a popular, quirky, family-run chain. Camille says Hobie's five locations each have their own unique vibe, but they're all known for the breakfast menu, healthy options, and their world-famous blueberry coffee cake.
So basically, it is a mile-high piece of coffee cake with blueberries on the inside and our famous streusel topping on top, which our customers always want more streusel topping because that's the best part.
Inside the kitchen, Juan Carlos Zaragoza is preparing a few batches of that famous coffee cake. He uses a metal bowl to scoop frozen blueberries out of a box and sprinkles them on the batter. He takes fistfuls of streusel topping and gently spreads it out with a flat hand. He's an artist. He's been making coffee cake at Hobie's for 25 years, and he's developed a following.
People's coming with, oh, who's in the kitchen? Oh, Juan Carlos. Okay, I'm happy. So,
keeping that close-knit feel to the restaurant was critical when the family decided to sell. They didn't want the new owners to only see Hobie's as a balance sheet. They looked at a few different buyers, but nothing felt right. That's when Ted Fike says they turned to Danny and Camille.
She's had so much experience in the business, and she and her husband were the logical successors to this business, and certainly to keep it in the family.
It wasn't easy. The Chihates used up their life savings, took a loan out against their house, and borrowed from friends and family.
So we really leveraged every possible, you know, avenue we could. You know, we really believe it's going to work, and it's going to be successful for us.
The Chihates have some plans to modernize the restaurant's technology and increase the number of locally sourced ingredients they use. But Camille says that coffee cake isn't going anywhere. And there's one other thing that won't change.
The reason that we're still successful is because people want a place that's familiar. It's kind of like the old Cheers thing. They want to be recognized. They want to know the employees. People come in here and they hug employees.
As if on cue, regular Tim Diebert gets up from his favorite table and gives Camille a hug. For the California Report, I'm Ryan Levy in Palo Alto.
Got an idea for a story about a small family-run business in California? We're launching a series we're calling Family Biz. Send us a note with your idea at calreport@kqed.org or reach out on Facebook. And now for some new music from Golden State artists. Producer Susie Racho is here to talk with the California Report's jazz critic, Andrew Gilbert, about two new albums. One reinvents the past, while the other conjures up a utopian future.
As I went to walking on a fine summer's morning, the birds in the bushes did whistle and sing.
The That's the Kronos Quartet, and for more than four decades, the San Francisco group has expanded the definition of what the string quartet is, and actually expanded the definition of what a classical string quartet takes on musically and on their latest folk songs. They're exploring traditional American music. Now, Andy, is there something that they've done before?
You know, they have worked with composers who draw on folk sources, but this is really the first time they've done something like this, put out an album like this, where the focus is really on the vocalist singing these traditional American songs.
So these are covers?
They are, in a really interesting way. It's really an arrangers album. They're working with arrangers like Nico Muhly and Jacob Garchik, who are referencing the sort of traditional sources, but they're also referencing earlier recordings, in some cases, by these singers. So we heard up top Rhiannon Giddens singing Factory Girl, the title track of an EP that she released that was actually Grammy-nominated a couple years back.
And can you just talk about a few of the vocalists here? I mean, there's some people who are definitely familiar. I mean, like Natalie Merchant from 10,000 Maniacs.
Absolutely. And she's done, you know, she's really gone in sort of a folk music direction and, you know, in recent years. And so this is right up her alley in a lot of ways. Sam Amadon, sort of an experimental folk singer. Let's listen to one of my favorite tracks on this. It's just this haunting piece, I See the Sign. Now, he had recorded this earlier with Nico Muhly, arrangement, and here they've sort of recast it, and Kronos just really heightens the drama of this piece.
I see the sun, hey Lord, time draws nigh. The sign of the judgment, sign of the judgment.
Kronos has had this career, it's been over 40 years of constant evolving musically and creatively. Where do you think this fits in their canon?
You know, I think, I mean, one of the amazing things about Kronos is they're always full of surprises. There's always new artists, they're, you know, always looking for young artists to work with. I mean, I didn't know what to expect when I put this on, and I was pleasantly surprised.
Sit on buttermilk ew. Who could blame me? Cry my fear, and every tear could turn a mill. Johnny has gone for a soul. That's
Kronos Quartet and Natalie Merchant from the record Folk Songs. And while Kronos Quartet is reimagining a musical past, flute player and composer Nicole Mitchell is exploring the future. Her album is called Mandorla Awakening to Emerging Worlds. Now, Andy, Nicole Mitchell might be well-known in the avant-garde jazz world, but what's her California connection?
She actually grew up in Southern California, mostly in Orange County, and she's been a professor at UC Irvine now for, I think, about 5 or 6 years. But she spent her formative years, about 20 years in Chicago, was very deeply involved in the Chicago scene, which has this great sort of Afrofuturist tradition going back to Sun Ra, really, which she has picked up on and made her own. And this album is sort of part of this sort of extended world she's been creating and exploring in her music. She really explores these ideas of duality. She sort of creates this storyline of a dystopia and a utopia, and how can you envision a utopian future, spirituality, materiality, a lot of really interesting issues. But the music, I mean, that would be interesting, but the music is often really beautiful.
That's Nicole Mitchell. Her album is Mandorla Awakening to Emerging Worlds. You can read more about that and Kronos Quartet's folk songs at californiareport.org. Thanks so much, Andy.
Great to be with you, Susie.
Andrew Gilbert covers jazz and world music for the California Report.
And finally this week, some news that I've been waiting for since last year.
You may begin.
I will, with great pride, move for adoption of this item.
More than 25 years after the state determined a chemical called 123-TCP caused cancer, this week the California Water Board voted to regulate the chemical in our drinking water.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All right. It carries. Thank you. An important, very important day for public health.
Last year, I did a story about this cancer-causing chemical. I was worried my family might be drinking it. Let's rewind to last spring and take a listen. I opened my water bill recently to find a little insert inside called the Consumer Confidence Report. I found a footnote in tiny print that says 29 wells in Fresno, where I live, have something called 123-trichloropropane. And that some people who drink water containing it over many years may have an increased risk of getting cancer based on studies in lab animals.
Okay, guys, come here.
Wait, what?
Come here, let's have some water.
I have two little kids, and my family drinks the tap water, so I decide to get it tested.
When you fill it up, no air bubbles, okay?
The guy at the lab shows me how to collect a water sample in a vial with hydrochloric acid. So I go home, put on some protective gear, and take a sample from my kitchen sink.
Mommy's going to put on these glasses.
For what?
I have to test our water.
Then I drop it off back at the lab.
Perfect. Thank you. So 10 days, right?
In the meantime, I try to find out more about 123-trichloropropane, or TCP. According to the state, it's been found in about 100 public water systems across California, mostly in the Central Valley, but also in counties like Santa Cruz, Monterey, Sacramento, and L.A. Starting in the 1940s and 50s, 123-TCP was a chemical manufacturing byproduct used in some soil fumigants. Farmers injected them into the ground to control nematodes, or microscopic worms.
This was the dawn of the age of chemical agriculture.
Todd Robbins is a San Francisco attorney who spent more than a decade tracking down how this contaminant leached into California groundwater. He represents water utilities with lawsuits against Dow Chemical and Shell, two companies that included 123-TCP in their soil fumigants until the 1980s.
This is a Shell document going back to 1949. When
Robbins has compiled a huge stack of documents that show neither Dow nor Shell listed 123-TCP on their product labels. One of Dow's own scientists admitted it served no purpose in killing nematodes. Robbins shows me a 1974 memo where Dow describes some of the fumigant components as garbage.
Some of the most startling information is how clearly the companies understood from a scientific perspective the amount of garbage they were putting into these products and knowingly having farmers essentially dispose of their hazardous waste for them on farm fields throughout our state.
In a few cases, Dow and Shell have paid to clean up groundwater with 123-TCP. But in the more than three dozen cases filed against the companies over the contamination, they've never admitted any wrongdoing. Some of those communities are really tiny, like Woodville, population 1,700, in rural Tulare County. Ralph Gutierrez runs the water system here.
I am the meter reader. I am the sewer line cleaner. I do the budget.
Gutierrez opens up the gate to one of the town's two drinking water wells, surrounded by orchards and cow pastures.
Dow and Shell are the ones that put this into the system. Obviously, they have money to attack their problems, but when you come to communities like this, they're all farm workers.
Gutierrez says there's no way he can raise water rates high enough to pay for expensive carbon filtration to keep it from reaching people's taps.
No, I wouldn't want my kids drinking it.
Take your vitamins.
Back in Fresno, I don't want my kids drinking our tap water until I know it's safe. I get an under-sink filter that says it takes out volatile organic compounds, but it doesn't say anything about 123-TCP.
Which one do we drink out of?
The filter!
The filter. Got it.
Both Dow and Shell declined my request for a taped interview. One Dow spokesman did write me that fumigants with TCP were part of what he called highly beneficial pest control products that have been off the market for several decades.
So it's been about 10 days since I dropped off the sample, and looks like the results just popped into my email. It
turns out the sample from my kitchen tap comes in at 2.2 parts per trillion. That doesn't sound like much, but it's three times the state public health goal. Not an enforceable goal, but a guideline set by California's Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment.
We've concluded that this is a very potent carcinogen.
Senior toxicologist Elaine Kahn says, based on the tests of my own water, my theoretical cancer risk would be 3 in a million over my lifetime.
How worried should I be? You know, the public health goals are really set at kind of a worst-case scenario, and we try to be as protective as possible. So it's not a bright line between safe and unsafe.
Some water systems in the Central Valley have contaminant levels that push the risk much higher, roughly 1 in 6,000. But many Californians don't even know if the stuff is in their water. Neither the state nor the feds regulate it in groundwater. Utilities don't even have to test for it. I just had to wonder, nearly 25 years after the state found this to be a carcinogen, why there isn't a standard for drinking water.
It's a great question.
That's Cindy Forbes, who's in charge of drinking water for the State Water Board.
We've put new staff, increased our resources, and it's our number one priority. We've had so many other regulations with limited resources to work on that we haven't been able to get it over the finish line.
Back in Fresno, officials say they'll switch from groundwater to drawing more water from rivers in 2 years. Until then, we get to wait and wonder what water from our taps might be doing to us, since no one seems to be sure. A couple updates since that story first aired last spring. I've moved my family away from Fresno to the Bay Area to host this program. And last month, the story you just heard won a National Edward R. Murrow Award for Investigative Reporting, a huge honor in radio journalism. We called the story, "There's a Cancer-Causing Chemical in My Drinking Water. Will California Finally Regulate It?" So the big news this week is state officials voted to finally set a limit for 123 TCP in California drinking water. That means water systems will have to test for it and clean it up. So Californians won't have to worry about that cancer-causing chemical coming out of our taps. The California Report magazine is a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. C.O. Muller is our technical producer. Our online producer is David Marks. The California Report's senior editor is Victoria Maulion. Our team includes Ryan Levy, Bianca Taylor, Leslie McClurg, Susie Racho, Julia McAvoy, Craig Miller, Ingrid Becker, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report magazine. Your state, your stories.
Support for the California Report comes from Barracuda Networks, cloud-ready firewalls engineered for today's next-generation business networks. Learn more at barracuda.com/cloud-ready. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. More at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.